What's Universal Time? Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting coordinated militant attacks in Egypt's Sinai killed dozens. An unprecedented attack left dozens dead Wednesday after militants launched several attacks on Egyptian military checkpoints in the Sinai Peninsula near the town of Sheikh Zuwait Wednesday. Egypt says 17 soldiers and officers were killed in hours of fighting, although there are conflicting reports that far more died. The attacks were claimed by loyalists to the Islamic State. The military says it killed 100 of the militants. John Kirby is a U.S. spokesman.
We express our sincere condolences to the victims, their families, and the government and people of Egypt. These attacks come as Egypt is mourning the assassination of its public prosecutor, Hisham Barakat, on Monday. The perpetrators of these cowardly crimes must be brought to justice. The United States remains steadfast in its support of the Egyptian government's efforts to combat terrorism in Egypt.
Islamic extremists have increasingly attacked security forces in Sinai since Mr. Sisi, a former military chief, led the army's overthrow of President Mohamed Morsi in 2013. President Obama announced Wednesday the U.S. and Cuba have agreed to reestablish diplomatic relations and plan to reopen embassies in Washington and Havana later this month, the latest sign of an easing of more than five decades of hostilities.
Last December, I announced that the United States and Cuba had decided to take steps to normalize our relationship. As part of that effort, President Raul Castro and I directed our teams to negotiate the reestablishment of embassies. Since then, our State Department has worked hard with their Cuban counterparts to achieve that goal. And later this summer, Secretary Kerry will travel to Havana formally to proudly raise the American flag over our embassy once more.
The U.S. trade embargo and Cuba's human rights record are among the issues still blocking normalized relations following Fidel Castro's revolution. This is VOA News. Greek Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras Wednesday said he's sticking with plans for a Sunday referendum on bailout terms demanded by European creditors. German Chancellor Angela Merkel said there will be no more negotiations until the outcome of Sunday's referendum is clear. The head of the International Monetary Fund, Christine Lagarde, expressed hope for the referendum.
A major decision was made last Friday to interrupt the negotiations on the part of Greece when it decided to launch a referendum this coming Sunday. I think there is a democratic process that is underway, and that should result in hopefully more clarity, less uncertainty as to what is the determination of the Greek people and what is the authority of the government.
Greece is cut off from further European aid after failing Tuesday to meet a midnight deadline for repaying nearly $2 billion to the IMF. That default marked the first time a developed country failed to meet a payment deadline on an IMF loan. The head of the UN's nuclear agency is to meet Iranian President Hassan Rouhani Thursday in Tehran. As negotiators from Iran and a group of six world powers continue working toward a comprehensive agreement ensuring the country's nuclear program remains peaceful. Yukiya Amano's visit expected to focus on access for inspectors who monitor nuclear activity in Iran. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry spoke Wednesday at the site of the nuclear talks in Vienna.
We are working very, very hard. We have some very difficult issues, but we believe we're making progress, and we're going to continue to work because of that.
Inspections and the pace at which sanctions are lifted against Iran are two remaining sticking points between Iranian negotiators and those from the U.S., Britain, China, France, Russia, and Germany. The two sides had set a Tuesday deadline originally, but extended those talks until July 7. At least six people, including a policeman, were killed Wednesday near Burundi's capital, Bujumbura, in the latest political violence, which first erupted in April, with the decision by President Pierre Nkurunziza to seek a controversial third term. Police were trying to disarm protesters when they say they came under attack and responded with lethal force. The more than 70 have died in clashes in the past 2 months. The opposition boycotted Monday's parliamentary election, the results of that ballot expected later in the week. The UN says the number of migrants crossing the Mediterranean to Europe in the first half of this year jumped by more than 80% from the same period last year. The new data published Wednesday shows nearly 140,000 people making the dangerous crossing between January and June. A third of them came from war-torn Syria. Eritreans and Afghans made up about 12% of the arrivals. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, July 2nd, and here are some of the stories we are covering. The United Nations imposes sanctions on 6 military commanders in South Sudan's conflict.
This is an important step forward. It's really the first multilateral evidence that we've seen of an attempt to hold people accountable for the gross human rights abuses that have taken place in South Sudan.
Akshaya Kumar is the Sudan and South Sudan policy analyst for the U.S.-based Enough Project. A United Nations report exposes widespread Boko Haram atrocities. Nigeria appoints an acting electoral commission chairperson. And Liberia confirms 2 more Ebola cases, and the president is not happy.
Very disturbing for us, but I'm very confident that our incident management system has the capability to contain this and to keep it to right where it is so that it doesn't go any further.
That's Liberian President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf. The United Nations calls the DRC to deploy its police force more widely, and Britain holds a major terror drill as Parliament considers Tunisia's response. Those stories plus Mark Oman's sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The United Nations Security Council Wednesday imposed sanctions on 6 military commanders from South Sudan for perpetrating that country's 19-month-old conflict. 3 government military generals and 3 rebel commanders are now subject to a global travel ban and an asset freeze. U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Samantha Power, said the sanctions demonstrate that those who commit atrocities and undermine peace will face consequences. Akshaya Kumar, the Sudan and South Sudan policy analyst for the U.S.-based Enough Project, says the sanctions are an important first step that will send a message of accountability and help forge an enabling environment for peace.
This is an important step forward. It's really the first multilateral evidence that we've seen of an attempt to hold people accountable for the gross human rights abuses that have taken place in South Sudan since December 2013. And so we applaud the Security Council for taking this decisive action, but we think it's just the first step of a series of steps needed to construct the leverage that will be essential to create an enabling environment for a durable and lasting peace.
Now, your organization has said that the responsibility for the war in South Sudan lies on the hands of the high-level officials who are responsible for negotiating. For example, President Salva Kiir, former Vice President Riek Machar. Did you want or do you want for these people to be accountable to, say, sanctions on them?
We believe that it is exactly true that those who bear the greatest responsibility for obstructing the peace and intransigence are the men who are sitting at the negotiating table. As far as sanctions, we really believe that it's important to follow the process. And so if evidence is available to show that individuals, however high they are up the chain of command in South Sudan, whoever they are, if individuals are responsible for violations that merit sanctions, then yes, they should be listed and named. Because until now, only the people of South Sudan are facing the grave consequences of this war, while the elite remain relatively insulated in this climate of impunity that's existed since 2013.
Now, these sanctions are coming at a time that it appears that Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta is making some headway by reuniting the Sudan People's Liberation Movement. I think this week there was some movement on that. There are those who say, particularly people from South Sudan, the officials say that sanctions will make things worse, do not help to bring about peace.
Sanctions in this case are an incredibly useful tool to push people to make important concessions at the negotiating table. And what we saw this week with the engagement between the former members of the SPLM and the current ruling elite of the SPLM was, again, more intransigence. Although they met for 5 hours at the same time, opposition forces were attempting to take control of the Paloch oil field and did, in fact, take control of Malakal. And so people seem to still be committed to a military solution, even though that is not the way that a durable and lasting peace will come to South Sudan. our view is that targeted asset freezes and travel bans could help to make those who are fanning the flames of war feel a cost of some of that war.
Akshaya Kumar is the Sudan and South Sudan policy analyst for the U.S.-based Enough Project. She was speaking with me from Washington, D.C. A damning report by the United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights graphically details a pattern of vicious and widespread atrocities committed by Boko Haram militants in northeastern Nigeria and neighboring Cameroon, Chad, and Niger. In an update of Boko Haram violations at the UN Human Rights Council, the High Commissioner condemned reported abusive treatment of Boko Haram victims by Nigerian security forces and regional authorities. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from the Council in Geneva.
The report shows violations committed by Boko Haram remain as extensive and far-reaching as they were when the UN Human Rights Council held a special session on the atrocities committed by the militant group in April. Interviews by UN staff with former captives and survivors of Boko Haram attacks in northeast Nigeria present a distressing picture of horrific abuse stretching back months and even years. They include massacres, the burning down of entire villages, torture and abduction on a massive scale, including of children. UN Human Rights Chief Zeid Ra'ad Al Hussein says survivors in Nigeria have given anguishing accounts of mass killings of men and boys gunned down or hacked to death by Boko Haram before the female inhabitants of villages were abducted.
Women and girls have been sexually enslaved, raped, and forced into so-called marriages. Many survivors of these horrific experiences are now pregnant by their rapists. It is vital that the authorities ensure that every person who has been responsible for such crimes will be held to account in a court of law.
While condemning these actions, Zaid says he's concerned about allegations of serious human rights violations committed by the Nigerian military forces. He also expresses dismay at reports of ill treatment by Nigerian and regional security forces of adults and even children who had been held captive by Boko Haram and subsequently freed. Zaid says they often are subjected to lengthy periods of detention without charge.
I must insist on the need for greater attention to human rights by both the military and the police forces in concerned countries when carrying out security operations against Boko Haram. Failure to uphold these principles could jeopardize recent successes against Boko Haram by driving more people into justifiable mistrust for the authorities.
Acting Foreign Minister of Nigeria, Bulu Lolo, reiterates his country's call for the international community to redouble its efforts to end the menace and evil perpetrated by Boko Haram.
Boko Haram's pledge of allegiance to ISIS is a wake-up call. It means that another link has been added to the terrorist chain that now connects other international terrorist groups such as Al-Shabaab and Al-Qaeda.
The Nigerian minister warns the association of terrorist groups has wider implications for the peace and stability of not only the sub-region, but Africa and the world at large. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Thursday, the second day of July, and please send your comments and opinions to Daybreak Africa at voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time, 14 minutes past the hour. Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari has appointed Amina Bala Zakari as the acting chairperson of the Independent National Electoral Commission, or INEC. Zakari takes over from Professor Ataheru Jega, whose term expired on Tuesday this week after serving a full five-year term. Nick Dazan, INEC's Deputy Director for Public Affairs, tells reporter Peter Clotty that Ms. Zakari took over the reins of INEC during a brief ceremony Wednesday.
The appointment of the National Commissioners and Chairman of the Commission, enshrined in sections 153 to 159 of the Constitution of the Federal Republic of Nigeria 1999 as amended. The chairman of the commission and national commissioners are usually appointed by the president and they serve a five-year tenure. Now, yesterday, the tour of duty of the former chairman, Professor Atahiru Jega, expired, as a result of which he now handed over to one of the national commissioners, Ambassador Mohammed Ahmed Wali. But much later in the evening, the president now approved the appointment of Commissioner Amina Zakari. And this morning, the former acting chairman, Ambassador Mohammed Ahmed Wali, has since handed over to her in a very brief and business-like ceremony in the chairman's office.
As the new acting chairperson, what would she be doing?
She does not need any confirmation because before now she was a serving national commissioner, one of the 12 national commissioners appointed by the president. And she was about to finish her own five-year tour of duty at the end of this month, July. But with the new appointment, what that means is that she can only vacate that office or be reappointed. But whatever happens, her letter says she is to serve as acting chairman pending the appointment of a substantive chairman.
So what is the current situation now with INEC after the election that brought in President Buhari? What is the current situation with the commission?
As you know, there are other elections we'll conduct even before 2019. So the day-to-day running of the affairs of the commission will be done by the acting chairman in collaboration with other commissioners whose terms or tenures have not expired. And she will do that pending the replacement of national commissioners whose tenures have expired. As we speak now, yesterday, the tenures of six other national commissioners plus the former chairman expired. So we now have a complement of the acting chairman and five other national commissioners to pilot the affairs of the commission.
Nick Dazan is the Deputy Director for Public Affairs of Nigeria's Independent Electoral Commission. He spoke with reporter Peter Clotty from the capital, Abuja. Liberia Wednesday confirmed two more cases of Ebola a few days after a young boy died from the virus. President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf says while the news is very disturbing, she's confident the country has the disease under control. Mariama Diallo reports from Dakar.
Liberian President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf told a group of reporters on Wednesday that health officials are trying to get to the source of the newest Ebola cases in her country.
Very disturbing for us, but I'm very confident that our incident management system has the capability to contain this, to isolate this, and to keep it to right where it is so that it doesn't go any further.
Fester Starpar is the information officer for Margibi County, where the first victim died.
At the deceased resident, there were three individuals who were also sick, and the health team quickly came in to take their samples, and results from the laboratory have proven that two confirmed new Ebola cases, and one is still indeterminate.
He told VOA that massive work to minimize damage has been done since last Sunday.
The family members, as I speak to you, have a total of 100 plus contacts that have been established, 55 of whom are primary contacts. So as we speak, there is an active case search and finding contact tracing going on in the Unification Town and Nindonwen areas.
Other health officials say they can handle the situation. Deputy Health Minister Talbert Nuenswa.
We are not frustrated. We are only disappointed. Our anticipation was we would have maintained our clean sheet. In terms of capacity and energy, we have the energy, we have the capacity.
He also refuted claims that the first victim is from Guinea, a country still battling the outbreak.
The information whether or not the case came from Guinea, nope. We don't have that information yet. What I do know is the facts are it's a 17-year-old male live in the Nidowan community near Smenotes. A student, he was going to school, he's a Liberian, he's not a Guinean.
Ebola has killed more than 11,200 people. Close to 5,000 of them were Liberians. Mariama Diallo, VOA News, in Dakar.
The United Nations mission in the Democratic Republic of Congo, known as MONUSCO, has called on the government to deploy its police force more widely. Currently, only a small number of police officers patrol many of the areas with high crime rates, and a five-year program to reform the police is lagging. Nick Long has more from Goma in eastern Congo.
During a recent conversation with reporters in Goma, MONUSCO chief Martin Kobler touted the successes in joint army and UN operations against rebels, but he stressed the importance of following up those successes with a permanent police presence. We can fight against the armed groups, Kobler says, but if the state's authority and the civil administration are not restored and the PNC, or Congo's National Police, are not deployed, the end result will not be a success. As an example, Kobler mentioned Bukaringi territory, which he visited recently. He says in that territory there are 64,000 inhabitants in 400 square kilometres and only four police officers, so about one officer for 16,000 people. The normal ratio, he adds, is about one for every 500 people. The latest official figures suggest there are about 100,000 police in the DRC, or approximately one for every 700 people nationwide. But Gento Maundu, a former president of civil society groups in North Kivu province, told VOA that figure needs updating. Perhaps only 60% of the names on the police list are of real police, says Maundu, and the rest are out of date or fictitious, although somebody is still drawing their salaries. There are many territories like Bukaringi where police presence is minimal, says Swedish academic Maria Eriksson Bars, an expert on Congo's security services.
Well, I would say that in many areas in the east, that they're simply not present. But you will also see, I mean, in general in the Congo, that there is a strong concentration of the PNC in urban areas. So you see that also in the western parts, but it's more here in the east. And it's, of course, partly due to the security situation.
There is clearly a limit to how far police can protect the population against armed groups. A government spokesman in South Kivu province, Minister Jean-Julien Miruho, told a public meeting in Bukavu recently that police had not intervened to prevent a nighttime massacre at the village of Mutarule last year because they lacked training. The police, Miruho says, are not trained for warfare. And when there is a lot of shooting, as there was that night, it is too much to expect people who are not trained to wage war to intervene at that time. In more peaceful areas, however, civilians also comment that the PNC are not widely deployed. Nick Long for VOA News, Goma.
Britain has pledged a tough response after last Friday's terror attack in Tunisia that killed up to 30 British tourists. The attack came just days before the 10th anniversary of the bomb attacks on London's transport network. As Henry Richwell reports, security services are having to shift the focus of their counter-terrorism operations overseas.
In eerily realistic scenes, three gunmen shoot their way into a London metro station. Outside, bodies lie in the street. Britain's emergency response is put to the test as police, fire and ambulance units rush to the scene. The two-day drill, taking place this week, is designed to mimic recent attacks in Paris and Sydney. For many Londoners, it's also a grim reminder of events 10 years ago. The July 7th bombings that targeted the city's transport network. Maxine De Brunner is Deputy Assistant Commissioner of London's Metropolitan Police Force.
Tragically, after 7/7, of course, we took the learning. We adapted our policies and our procedures. But styles of attack, they also change, and we have to evolve and make sure that we're ready and we have the right skills to be able to respond.
Security services say the drill is not in response to Friday's attack in Sousse, Tunisia, that killed at least 38 people, the majority of them British. Survivors have been returning to emotional homecomings. Bodies are also being repatriated. British Prime Minister David Cameron vowed a tough response.
First, we must give our police and security services the tools they need to root out this poison. We must be stronger at standing up for our values, and we must be more intolerant of intolerance.
But the heart of counter-terrorism is shifting overseas, says Raffaello Pantucci of the Royal United Services Institute.
The ideology is such now that it basically says you attack Westerners wherever you can find them and whatever they look like. And so whatever target becomes possible becomes a potential target. The problem is that multiplies the sort of number of potential targets and in a huge number of potential countries.
Tunisia's president, Beji Caid Essebsi, admitted Tuesday that security services were taken by surprise.
Ils ont pris des dispositions pour le mois de Ramadan.
The president said the security forces made provisions for the month of Ramadan, but he said they never would have thought that it would happen on the beaches where the tourists are. David Cameron has not specified the policies that will form his response to the Tunisia attacks. It must involve working with overseas allies, says Pantucci. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
Time now for Daybreak Africa Sports. And here is Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Very good Thursday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we begin with athletics. Olympic 1500-meter champion Taufik Maklouf won men's 1,000 meters in an Algerian record of 2 minutes and 13.08 seconds at the European Athletics Classic meet in Tomblain, France, on Wednesday night. Ivory Coast's Marie-José Talou triumphed in women's 100 meters in 11.23 seconds as Kenyan Nicholas Kipkoech won the 800 meters in 1 minute and 45.17 seconds. Lesotho's Mosito Lehata was runner-up in 200 meters as Zambia's Bange Mupopo was second in women's 400 meters. In Slovenia, South Africa, Nakani Simbini won 100 meters in a lifetime best of 9.99 seconds at the European Athletics Classic meet in Velenje on Wednesday night. Ethiopian Bezuayehu Mohamed triumphed in women's 3,000 meters steeplechase in 9 minutes and 50.19 seconds. South Africans Reinhard van Rensburg and Justin Palfreman were second in men's and women's 800 meters and 200 meters respectively. Turning to basketball, Spain narrowly beat Egypt 67-60 as hosts Greece outplayed Tunisia 100-48 as Africa's quest for a place in the quarterfinals came to an end at the Men's World Under-19 Basketball Championships in Heraklion on Wednesday. In football news, the Council of Eastern Central Africa Football Association's SEKAFA Kagame Club Championship will be staged in Dar es Salaam, Tanzania from the 18th July, SEKAFA Secretary General Nicholas Musonye revealed in Dar es Salaam on Wednesday. The two-week contest features 13 clubs drawn in three preliminary round groups. Group A consists of Tanzania mainland's Young Africans, popularly known as Yanga, Kenya's Gor Mahia, Djibouti's Telecom, Zanzibar's KMKM, and Sudan's Khartoum N. Rwanda's military side APR, who were runners-up last year, head Group B, where they meet Sudan's El Shandi, Burundi's LLB AFC, and Somalia's Hegan. Group C includes Tanzania mainland's Azam, South Sudan's Malakia, Ethiopia's Adama City, and Uganda's Kampala City Council Authority. The contest will have a new champion as Sudanese title holders El Merrekh withdrew from the contest. Rwanda President Paul Kagame has pledged the prize money of $30,000, $20,000, and $10,000 for the top three teams in descending order. Kagame has sponsored the prize money at this annual event since 2002. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day. And that is it for this Thursday, July 2nd edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Mark Ouma, along with our engineer Carl Sterling, I'm James Butting in Washington, wishing all of you in Africa a very good Thursday.
Hello, I'm Douglas Simboga. Join me for VOA's discussion program, Reporters Roundtable, every Thursday at 17:30 UTC. We'll have African journalists and expert guests share their ideas and take an in-depth look at an African news topic important to you. So please plan to be with us every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA.
Hello, sports fans. This is Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports. Please join me Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. And on Fridays, you can also hear my 30-minute show at 17:30 UTC. On the internet, like me on Facebook, follow me on Twitter, and read my blog. Check voaafrica.com for the addresses and enjoy the show.